twisted in distaste. The blood was in him.
But not in you, father. There's no blood in Tywin Lannister.
Was it a soft silk pillow that slew Robb Stark? It was to be an arrow at Edmure Tully's wedding feast. The boy was too wary in the field. He kept his men in good order and surrounded himself with outriders and bodyguards.
So Lord Walder slew him under his own roof, at his own table. Tyrion made a fist. What of Lady Catelyn?
Slain as well, I'd say. A pair of wolfskins. Frey had intended to keep her captive, but perhaps something went awry.
So much for guessed right.
The blood is on Walder Frey's hands, and not mine.
Walder Frey is a peevish old man who lives to fondle his young wife and brood over all the slights he suffered. I have no doubt he hatched this ugly chicken, but he would never have dared such a thing without a promise of protection.
I suppose you would have spared the boy, and told Lord Frey you had no need of his allegiance. That would have driven the old fool right back into Stark's arms, and won you another year of war. Explain to me why it is more noble to kill 10,000 men in battle than a dozen at dinner.
When Tyrion had no reply to that, his father continued,
"The price was cheap by any measure. The crown shall grant River Run to Sir Eamon Frey once the Blackfish yields. Lancel and Devon must marry Frey girls. Joy is to wed one of Lord Walder's natural sons when she's old enough, and Roose Bolton becomes Warden of the North and takes home Arya Stark."
"Arya Stark?" Tyrion cocked his head. "And Bolton? I might have known Frey would not have the stomach to act alone, but Arya? Varys and Sir Jaslyn searched for her for more than half a year. Arya Stark is surely dead."
"So was Renly, until the Blackwater."
"What does that mean?"
"Perhaps Littlefinger succeeded where you and Varys failed. Lord Bolton will wed the girl to his bastard son. We shall allow the Dreadfort to fight the Ironborn for a few years, and see if he can bring Stark's other bannermen to heel. Come spring, all of them should be at the end of their strength, and ready to bend the knee. The North will go to your son by Sansa Stark, if you ever find enough manhood in you to breed one. Lest you forget, it is not only Joffrey who must needs take a maidenhead."
"I had not forgotten, though I'd hoped you had. And when do you imagine Sansa will be at her most fertile?" Tyrion asked his father in tones that dripped acid. "Before or after I tell her how we murdered her mother and her brother?" Davos. For a moment it seemed as though the king had not heard. Stannis showed no pleasure at the news, no anger, no disbelief, not even relief. He stared at his painted table with teeth clenched hard. "You are certain?" he asked.
"I am not seeing the body, no, your kingliness," said Salladhor Saan. "Yet in the city the lions prance and dance. The Red Wedding, the small folk are calling it. They swear Lord Frey had the boy's head hacked off, sewed the head of his direwolf in its place, and nailed a crown about his ears. His lady mother was slain as well, and thrown naked in the river."
"At a wedding," thought Davos, "as he sat at his slayer's board, a guest beneath his roof. These Freys are cursed."
He could smell the burning blood again, and hear the leech hissing and spitting on the brazier's hot coals.
"It was the Lord's wrath that slew him," Sir Axel Florin declared. "It was the hand of R'hllor." "Praise the Lord of Light," sang out Queen Selyse, a pinched, thin, hard woman with large ears and a hairy upper lip.
"Is the hand of R'hllor spotted and palsied?" asked Stannis. "This sounds more Walder Frey's handiwork than any god's." Renaud chooses such instruments as he requires. The ruby at Melisande's throat shone redly. His ways are mysterious, yet no man may withstand his fiery will.
"No man can withstand him," the queen cried.
"Be quiet, woman. You're not at a night fire now." Stannis considered the painted table. "The wolf leaves no heirs. The kraken too many. The lions will devour them unless... Son, I will require your fastest ships to carry envoys to the Iron Islands and White Harbor. I shall offer... pardons." The way he snapped his teeth showed how little he liked that word. "Full pardons for all those who repent of treason and swear fealty to their rightful king. They must see..."
"They will not." Melisande's voice was soft. "I am sorry, Your Grace. This is not an end. More false kings will soon rise to take up the crowns of those who've died."
"More?" Stannis looked as though he would gladly have throttled her. "More usurpers? More traitors?"
"I have seen it in the flames."
Queen Selyse went to the king's side.
"The Lord of Light sent Melisande to guide you to your glory. Heed her, I beg you. Relore's holy flames do not lie."
"There are lies and lies, woman. Even when the flames speak truly, they are full of tricks, it seems to me."
"An ant who hears the words of a king may not comprehend what he is saying," Melisande said, "and all men are ants before the fiery face of God. If sometimes I have mistaken a warning for a prophecy, or a prophecy for a warning, the fault lies in the reader, not the book. But this I know for a certainty. Envoys and pardons will not serve you now, no more than leeches. You must show the realm a sign that proves your power."
"Power?" The king snorted. "I have 1,300 men on Dragonstone, another 300 at Storm's End." His hands swept over the painted table. "The rest of Westeros is in the hands of my foes. I have no fleet but Salador Sands, no coin to hire sellswords, no prospect of plunder or glory to lure free riders to my cause."
"Lord husband," said Queen Selyse, "you have more men than Aegon did 300 years ago. All you lack are dragons."
The look Stannis gave her was dark. 9 mages cross the sea to hatch Aegon the Third's cache of eggs. Baelor the Blessed prayed over his for half a year. Aegon the Fourth built dragons of wood and iron. Arian Brightflame drank wildfire to transform himself. The mages failed. King Baelor's prayers went unanswered. The wooden dragons burned, and Prince Arian died screaming. Queen Selyse was adamant.
"None of these was the chosen of R'hllor. No red comet blazed across the heavens to herald their coming. None wielded Lightbringer, the red sword of heroes, and none of them paid the price. Lady Melisande will tell you, my lord, only death can pay for life."
"The boy!" The king almost spat the words.
"The boy!"
agreed the queen.
"The boy!"
Sir Axel echoed. "I was sick unto death of this wretched boy before he was even born," the king complained. "His very name is a roaring in my ears and a dark cloud upon my soul."
"Give the boy to me, and you need never hear his name spoken again," Melisande promised.
"No, but you'll hear him screaming when she burns him."
Davos held his tongue. It was wiser not to speak until the king commanded it.
"Give me the boy for R'hllor," the red woman said, "and the ancient prophecy shall be fulfilled. Your dragon shall awaken and spread his stony wings. The kingdom shall be yours."
Sir Axel went to one knee.
"On bended knee, I beg you, sire, wake the stone dragon and let the traitors tremble. Like Aegon, you begin as Lord of Dragonstone. Like Aegon, you shall conquer. Let the false and the fickle feel your flames."
"Your own wife begs as well, Lord Husband."
Queen Selyse went down on both knees before the king, hands clasped as if in prayer.
"Robert Anne Delina defiled our bed and laid a curse upon our union. This boy is the foul fruit of their fornications. Lift his shadow from my womb, and I will bear you many true-born sons, I know it.' She threw her arms around his legs. "'He is only one boy born of your brother's lust and my cousin's shame. "'He is mine own blood. Stop clutching me, woman!' King Stannis put a hand on her shoulder, awkwardly untangling himself from her grasp. "'Perhaps Robert did curse our marriage bed. "'He swore to me that he never meant to shame me, that he was drunk, "'and never knew which bedchamber he entered that night. "'But does it matter? The boy was not at fault, whatever the truth.' Melisande put a hand on the king's arm. "'The Lord of Light cherishes the innocent. "'There's no sacrifice more precious. "'From his king's blood and his untainted fire, a dragon shall be born.' Stannis did not pull away from Melisande's touch, as he had from his queen's. The Red Woman was all Selyse was not, young, full-bodied, and strangely beautiful, with her heart-shaped face, coppery hair, and unearthly red eyes. "'It would be a wondrous thing to see stone come to life,' he admitted grudgingly, "'and to mount a dragon. "'I remember the first time my father took me to court. "'Robert had to hold my hand. "'I could not have been older than 4, which would have made him 5 or 6. "'We agreed afterward that the king had been as noble as the dragons were fearsome.' "'Stannis snorted. "'Years later, our father told us that Aerys had cut himself on the throne that morning, so his hand had taken his place. It was Tywin Lannister who'd so impressed us. His fingers touched the surface of the table, tracing a path lightly across the varnished hills. Robert took the skulls down when he'd done the crown, but he could not bear to have them destroyed. Dragon wings over Westeros. There would be such a... Your Grace... Davos edged forward. "'Might I speak?' Stannis closed his mouth so hard his teeth snapped. "'My Lord of the Rainwood, why do you think I made your hand, if not to speak?' The king waved a hand. "'Say what you will.'
"'Warrior, make me brave. I know little of dragons and less of gods, but the queen spoke of curses. No man is as cursed as a kinslayer in the eyes of gods and men.'
There are no gods save R'hllor, and the other whose name must not be spoken.
Melisande's mouth made a hard red line.
And small men curse what they cannot understand.
I am a small man, Davos admitted. So tell me why you need this boy, Edric Storm, to wait your great stone dragon, my lady.
He was determined to say the boy's name as often as he could.
Only death can pay for life, my lord. A great gift requires a great sacrifice.
Where is the greatness in a base-born child?
He has king's blood in his veins. You have seen what even a little of that blood could do.
I saw you burn some leeches.
And 2 false kings are dead.
Robb Stark was murdered by Lord Walder of the Crossing, and we have heard that Balon Greyjoy fell from a bridge. Who did your leeches kill?
Do you doubt the power of R'hllor? No.
Davos remembered too well the living shadow that had squirmed from out of her womb, that night beneath Storm's End, its black hands pressing at her thighs.
I must go carefully here, or some shadow may come seeking me as well. Even an onion smuggler knows 2 onions from 3. You are short a king, my lady.
Stannis gave a snort of laughter.
"'He has you there, my lady. 2 is not 3.'
"'To be sure, your grace, 1 king might die by chance, even 2. But 3? "'If Joffrey should die in the midst of all his power, surrounded by his armies and king's guard, would not that show the power of the Lord at work?'
"'It might.'
The king spoke as if he grudged every word.
"'Or not.'
Davos did his best to hide his fear.
"'Joffrey shall die,'
Queen Selyse declared, serene in her confidence.
"'It may be that he's dead already,'
Sir Axel added. Stannis looked at them with annoyance. "'Are you trained crows to croak at me in turns. Enough!
Husband, hear me, the queen entreated.
Why? Two is not three. Kings can count as well as smugglers. You may go.
Stannis turned his back on them. Melisande helped the queen to her feet. Selyse swept stiffly from the chamber, the red woman trailing behind. Sir Axel lingered long enough to give Davos one last look.
An ugly look and an ugly face, he thought as he met the stare.
After the others had gone, Davos cleared his throat. The king looked up.
Why are you still here?
Sire, about Edric Storm.
Stannis made a sharp gesture.
Spare me.
Davos persisted.
Your daughter takes her lessons with him, and plays with him every day in Aegon's garden.
I know that.
Her heart would break if anything ill should.
I know that as well.
If you would only see him.
I have seen him.
He looks like Robert.
Aye, and worships him.
Shall I tell him how often his beloved father ever gave him a thought? My brother liked the making of children well enough, but after birth they were a bother.
He asks after you every day. He—
You're making me angry, Davos. I will hear no more of this bastard boy.
His name is Edric Storm, sire.
I know his name. Was there ever a name so apt? It proclaims his bastardy, his high birth, and the turmoil he brings with him. Edric Storm. There, I've said it.
Are you satisfied, my lord hand?
Edric,
he started,
is one boy. He may be the best boy who ever drew breath, and it would not matter. My duty is to the realm.
His hand swept across the painted table.
How many boys dwell in Westeros? How many girls? How many men? How many women? The darkness will devour them all, she says. The night that never ends. She talks of prophecies. A hero reborn in the sea, living dragons hatched from dead stone. She speaks of signs, and swears they point at me.
I never asked for this, no more than I asked to be king.
Yet dare I disregard her?
He ground his teeth.
We do not choose our destinies, yet we must do our duty. No, great or small, we must do our duty.
Melisande swears that she has seen me in her flames, facing the dark, with Lightbringer raised on high.
Lightbringer!
Stannis gave a derisive snort.
Cheh! It glimmers prettily, I'll grant you, but on the Blackwater this magic sword served me no better than any common steel.
A dragon would have turned that battle.
Aegon once stood here, as I do, looking down on this table. Do you think we would name him Aegon the Conqueror today, if he had not had dragons?
Your grace, said Davos, the cost.
I know the cost.
Last night, gazing into that hearth, I saw things in the flames as well. I saw a king, a crown of fire on his brows, burning. Burning, Davos. His own crown consumed his flesh and turned him into ash. Do you think I need Melisande to tell me what that means? Or you?
The king moved so his shadow fell upon King's Landing.
If Joffrey should die, what is the life of one bastard boy against a kingdom?
Everything, said Davos softly.
Stannis looked at him, jaw clenched.
Go,
the king said at last, before you talk yourself back into the dungeon. Sometimes the storm winds blow so strong, a man has no choice but to furl his sails.
Aye, your grace.
Davos bowed, but Stannis had seemingly forgotten him already. It was chilly in the yard when he left the stone drum. A wind blew briskly from the east, making the banner snap and flap noisily along the walls. Davos could smell salt in the air.
The sea.
He loved that smell. It made him want to walk a deck again, to raise his canvas and sail off south, to Maria and his two small ones. He thought of them most every day now, and even more at night. Part of him wanted nothing so much as to take Devon and go home.
I cannot. Not yet. I am a lord now, and the king's hand. I must not fail him.
He raised his eyes to gaze up at the walls. In place of Merlin's, 1,000 grotesques and gargoyles looked down on him, each different from all the others. Wyverns, griffins, demons, manticores, minotaurs, basilisks, hellhounds, cockatrices, and 1,000 queerer creatures sprouted from the castle's battlements as if they'd grown there. And the dragons were everywhere. The great hall was a dragon lying on its belly. Men entered through its open mouth. The kitchens were a dragon curled up in a ball, with the smoke and steam of the ovens vented through its nostrils. The towers were dragons hunched above the walls or poised for flight. The windworm seemed to scream defiance, while Sea Dragon Tower gazed serenely out across the waves. Smaller dragons framed the gates. Dragon claws emerged from walls to grasp at torches. Great stone wings enfolded the smith and armory, and tails formed arches, bridges, and exterior stairs. Davos had often heard it said that the wizards of Valyria did not cut and chisel, as common masons did, but work stone with fire and magic, as a potter might work clay. But now he wondered, what if they were real dragons, somehow turned to stone? If the Red Woman brings them to life, the castle will come crashing down, I'm thinking. What kind of dragons are full of rooms and stairs and furniture, and windows, and chimneys, and privy shafts? Davos turned to find Salador San beside him. Does this mean you have forgiven my treachery, Salar? The old pirate wagged a finger at him. Forgiving, yes. Forgetting, no. All that good gold on Claw Isle, that might have been mine. It makes me tired and old to think of it. When I die impoverished, my wives and my concubines will curse you, Onion Lord. Lord Celtigar had many fine wines that now I am not tasting. A sea eagle he had trying to fly from the wrist, and a magic horn to summon krakens from the deep. Very useful such a horn would be to pull down Tairashi and other vexing creatures. But do I have this horn to blow? No, because the king made my old friend, his hand. He slipped his arm through Davos's and said, the queen's men love you not, old friend. I am hearing that a certain hand has been making friends of his own. This is true, yes? You err too much, you old pirate. A smuggler had best know men as well as tides, or he would not live to smuggle long. The Queen's men might remain fervent followers of the Lord of Light, but the lesser folk of Dragonstone were drifting back to the guards they'd known all their lives. They said Stannis was ensorcelled, that Melisandre had turned him away from the Seven to bow before some demon out of shadow and, worst sin of all, that she and her god had failed him. And there were knights and lordlings who felt the same. Davos had sought them out, choosing them with the same care with which he'd once picked his crews. Sir Gerald Gower had fought stoutly on the Blackwater, but afterward had been heard to say that R'hllor must be a feeble god to let his followers be chased off by a dwarf and a dead man. Sir Andrew Estamont was the king's cousin and had served as his squire years ago. The bastard of Nightsong had commanded the rear guard that allowed Stannis to reach the safety of Salador San's galleys, but he worshipped the warrior with a faith as fierce as he was.
King's men, not queen's men.
But it would not do to boast of them.
A certain Lycian pirate once told me that a good smuggler stays out of sight,
Davos replied carefully.
Black sails, muffled oars, and a crew that knows how to hold their tongues.
The Lycini laughed.
A crew with no tongues is even better, eh? Big, stronger mutes who cannot read or write.
But then he grew more somber.
But I am glad to know that someone watches your back, old friend. Will the king give the boy to the Red Priestess, do you think? One little dragon could end this great big war.
Old habit made him reach for his luck, but his finger bones no longer hung about his neck, and he found nothing.
He will not do it, said Davos. He could not harm his own blood. Lord Renly would be glad to hear this.
Renly was a traitor in arms. Edric Storm is innocent of any crime. His Grace is a just man.
Sala shrugged.
Well, we shall be seeing. Or you shall. For myself, I am returning to sea. Even now, rascally smugglers may be sailing across the Blackwater Bay, hoping to avoid paying their lord's lawful duties.
He slapped Davos on the back.
Take care. You, with your mute friends, you are grown so very great now. Yet the higher a man climbs, the farther he has to fall.
Davos reflected on those words as he climbed the steps of Sea Dragon Tower to the maester's chambers below the rookery. He did not need Sala to tell him he had risen too high.
I cannot read. I cannot write. The lords despise me. I know nothing of ruling. How can I be the king's hand? I belong on the deck of a ship, not in a castle tower.
He had said as much to Maester Pylos. You are a notable captain, the maester replied. A captain rules his ship, does he not? He must navigate treacherous waters, set his sails to catch the rising wind, know when a storm is coming, and how best to weather it. This is much the same. Pylos meant it kindly, but his assurances rang hollow.
It's not at all the same, Davos had protested. A kingdom's not a ship, and a good thing, or this kingdom would be sinking. I know wood and rope and water, yes, but how will that serve me now? Where do I find the wind to blow King Stannis to his throne?
The maester laughed at that. And there you have it, my lord. Words are wind, you know, and you've blown mine away with your good sense. His Grace knows what he has in you, I think.
Onions, said Davos glumly. That is what he has in me. The king's hand should be a high-born lord, someone wise and learned, a battle commander or a great knight.
Sir Roam Redwine was the greatest knight of his day, and one of the worst hands ever to serve a king. Septon Murmison's prayers worked miracles, but as hand he soon had the whole realm praying for his death. Lord Botterwell was renowned for wit, Miles Smallwood for courage, Sir Otto Hightower for learning, yet they failed as hands, every one. As for birth, the Dragon Kings oft chose hands from amongst their own blood, with the results as various as Balor Breakspear and Maegor the Cruel. Against this you have Septon Barth, the blacksmith's son the old king plucked from the Red Keep's library, who gave the realm 40 years of peace and plenty. Pylos smiled. Read your history, Lord Davos, and you will see that your doubts are groundless.
How can I read history when I cannot read?
Any man can read, my lord, said Maester Pylos. There is no magic needed, nor high birth. I'm teaching the art to your son at the king's command. Let me teach you as well.
It was a kindly offer, and not one that Davos could refuse. And so every day he repaired to the maester's chambers, high atop Sea Dragon Tower, to frown over scrolls and parchments and great leather tomes, and try to puzzle out a few more words. His efforts often gave him headaches, and made him feel as big a fool as Patchface, besides. His son Devon was not yet 12, yet he was well ahead of his father. And for Princess Shireen and Edric Storm, reading seemed as natural as breathing. When it came to books, Davos was more a child than any of them. Yet he persisted. He was a king's hand now, and a king's hand should read. The narrow, twisting steps of Sea Dragon Tower had been a sore trial to Maester Cresson after he broke his hip. Davos still found himself missing the old man. He thought Stannis must as well. Pylos seemed clever and diligent and well-meaning, but he was so young, and the king did not confide in him as he had in Cresson. The old man had been with Stannis so long, until he ran afoul of Melisandre and died for it. At the top of the steps, Davos heard a soft jingle of bells that could only herald Patchface. The princess's fool was waiting outside the maester's door for her like a faithful hound. Doe soft and slump-shouldered, his broad face tattooed in a motley pattern of red and green squares, Patchface wore a helm made of a rack of deer antlers strapped to a tin bucket. A dozen bells hung from the tines and rang when he moved, which meant constantly, since the fool seldom stood still. He jingled and jangled his way everywhere he went. Small wonder that Pylos had exiled him from Shireen's lessons.
"Under the sea, the old fish eat the young fish,"
the fool muttered at Davos. He bobbed his head, and his bells clanged and chimed and sang,
I know, oh ho ho.
"Up here, the young fish teach the old fish," said Davos, who never felt so ancient as when he sat down to try and read. It might have been different if aged Maester Cresson had been the one teaching him, but Pylos was young enough to be his son. He found the maester seated at his long wooden table, covered with books and scrolls, across from the three children. Princess Shireen sat between the two boys. Even now Davos could take great pleasure in the sight of his own blood keeping company with a princess and a king's bastard.
"Davin will be a lord now, not merely a knight. The Lord of the Rainwood."
Davos took more pride in that than in wearing the title himself.
"He reads, too. He reads and he writes, as if he'd been born to it."
Pylos had naught but praise for his diligence, and the master-at-arms, said Devon, was showing promise, with sword and lance as well.
"And he is a godly lad, too."
"My brothers have ascended to the Hall of Light to sit beside the Lord,"
Devon had said when his father told him how his four elder brothers had died.
"I will pray for them at the night fires, and for you as well, father, so you might walk in the light of the Lord till the end of your days."
"Good morrow to you, father," the boy greeted him.
"He looks so much like Dale did at his age,"
Davos thought. His elders had never dressed so fine as Devon in his squire's raiment, to be sure, but they shared the same square, plain face, the same forthright brown eyes, the same thin brown flyaway hair. Devon's cheeks and chin were dusted with blonde hair, a fuzz that would have shamed a proper peach, though the boy was fiercely proud of his beard.
"Just as Dale was proud of his once."
Devon was the oldest of the three children at the table. Yet Edric Storm was 3 inches taller and broader in the chest and shoulders. He was his father's son in that, nor did he ever miss a morning's work with sword and shield. Those old enough to have known Robert and Renly as children said that the bastard boy had more of their look than Stannis had ever shared. The coal-black hair, the deep blue eyes, the mouth, the jaw, the cheekbones. Only his ears reminded you that his mother had been a Florent.
"Yes, good morrow, my lord," Edric echoed. The boy could be fierce and proud, but the maesters and castellans and masters-at-arms who'd raised him had schooled him well in courtesy.
"Do you come for my uncle? How fares his grace?"
"Well,"
Davos lied. If truth be told, the king had a haggard, haunted look about him, but he saw no need to burden the boy with his fears.
"I hope I have not disturbed your lesson."
"We had just finished, my lord,"
Maester Pylos said.
"We were reading about King Daeron the First."
Princess Shireen was a sad, sweet, gentle child, far from pretty. Stannis had given her his square jaw and Selyse her florent ears, and the guards in their cruel wisdom had seen fit to compound her homeliness by afflicting her with grayscale in the cradle. The disease had left one cheek and half her neck grey and cracked and hard, though it had spared both her life and her sight.
"He went to war and conquered Dorne, the young dragon, they called him."
"He worshipped false gods," said Devon, "but he was a great king otherwise, and very brave in battle."
"He was," agreed Edric Storm, "but my father was braver. The young dragon never won 3 battles in a day."
The princess looked at him wide-eyed.
"Did Uncle Robert win 3 battles in a day?"
The bastard nodded.
"It was when he'd first come home to call his banners.
Lords Grandison, Caffrine, and Fell planned to join their strength at Summerhall and march on Storm's End. But he learned their plans from an informer and rode at once with all his knights and squires. As the plotters came up on Summerhall, one by one, he defeated each of them in turn before they could join up with the others. He slew Lord Fell in single combat and captured his son, Silver Axe. Devon looked to Pylos.
Is that how it happened?
I said so, didn't I? Edric Storm said before the maester could reply. He smashed all three of them, and fought so bravely that Lord Grandison and Lord Caffarine became his men afterwards, and Silver Axe too. No one ever beat my father.
Edric, you ought not to boast, Maester Pylos said. King Robert suffered defeats like any other man. Lord Tyrell bested him at Ashford, and he lost many a tawny tilt as well.
He won more than he lost, though, and he killed Prince Rhaegar on the Trident.
That he did, the maester agreed. But now I must give my attention to Lord Davos, who has waited so patiently. We will read more of King Daeron's conquest of Dorne on the morrow.
Princess Shireen and the boy said their farewells courteously. When they had taken their leaves, Maester Pylos moved closer to Davos.
My lord, perhaps you would like to try a bit of conquest of Dorne as well.
He slid the slender, leather-bound book across the table. King Daeron wrote with an elegant simplicity, and his history is rich with blood, battle, and bravery. Your son is quite engrossed.
My son is not quite 12. I am the king's hand. Give me another letter, if you would.
As you wish, my lord.
Maester Pylos rummaged about his table, unrolling and then discarding various scraps of parchment.
There are no new letters, perhaps an old one.
Davos enjoyed a good story as well as any man, but Stannis had not named him hand for his enjoyment, he felt. His first duty was to help his king rule, and for that he must needs understand the words the ravens brought. The best way to learn a thing was to do it, he had found. Sails or scrolls, it made no matter.
This might serve our purpose.
Pylos passed him a letter. Davos flattened down the little square of crinkled parchment and squinted at the tiny, crabbed letters. Reading was hard on the eyes, that much he had learned early. Sometimes he wondered if the Citadel offered a champion's purse to the maester who wrote the smallest hand. Pylos had laughed at the notion, but...
To the five kings, read Davos, hesitating briefly over five, which he did not often see written out. The king be... The king be where?
Beyond, the maester corrected. Davos grimaced.
The king beyond the wall comes south. He leads a vast host of wildlings. Lord Mormont sent a raven from the haunted forest.
Pylos underlined the words with the point of his finger.
The haunted forest. He is under attack.
Yes. Pleased, he ploughed onward.
Arthur birds have come since with no words. We fear Mormont slain with all his tench. No strength. We fear Mormont slain with all his strength.
Davos suddenly realized just what he was reading. He turned the letter over and saw that the wax that had sealed it had been black.
This is from the Night's Watch. Maester, has King Stannis seen this letter?
I brought it to Lord Alistair when it first arrived. He was the hand then. I believed he discussed it with the Queen. When I asked him if he wished to send a reply, he told me not to be a fool. His Grace lacks the men to fight his own battles. He has none to waste on wildlings, he said to me.
That was true enough, and this talk of five kings would certainly have angered Stannis.
"Only a starving man begs bread from a beggar," he muttered.
"Pardon, my lord?"
"Something my wife once said."
Davos drummed his shortened fingers against the tabletop. The first time he had seen the wall, he had been younger than Devon, serving aboard the Cobblecat
under Roro Euhorus. A Tri-Rushi, known up and down the narrow sea as the Blind Bastard, though he was neither blind nor baseborn. Roro had sailed past Skagus into the shivering sea, visiting 100 little coves that had never seen a trading ship before. He brought steel, swords, axes, helms, good chainmail hauberks to trade for furs, ivory, amber, and obsidian. When the Cobblecat turned back south, her holds were stuffed, but in the Bay of Seals, three black galleys came out to herd her into Eastwatch. They lost their cargo, and the bastard lost his head, for the crime of trading weapons to the wildlings. Davis had traded at Eastwatch in his smuggling days. The Black Brothers made hard enemies but good customers, for a ship with the right cargo. But while he may have taken their coin, he never forgot how the blind bastard's head had rolled across the Cobblecat's deck.
"I met some wildlings when I was a boy," he told Maester Pylos. "They were fair thieves, but bad hagglers. One made off with our cabin girl. All in all, they seem men like any other men, some fair, some foul."
"Men are men," Maester Pylos agreed. "Shall we return to our reading, my Lord Hand?"
"I am the Hand of the King, yes."
Stannis might be the King of Westeros in name, but in truth he was King of the Painted Table. He held Dragonstone and Storm's End, and had an ever more uneasy alliance with Salador San, but that was all. How could the Watch have looked to him for help?
"They may not know how weak he is, how lost his cause. King Stannis never saw this letter. You're quite certain? Nor Melisande?"
"No. Should I bring it to them, even now?"
"No," Davos said at once. "You did your duty when you brought it to Lord Alistair. If Melisande knew of this letter, what was it she had said? One whose name may not be spoken is marshalling his powers, Davos Seaworth. Soon comes a cold, and a night that never ends."
And Stannis had seen a vision in the flames, a ring of torches in the snow with terror all around. "My lord, are you unwell?" asked Pylos.
"I am frightened, maester," he might have said.
Davos was remembering a tale Salador San had told him, of how Azor Ahai tempered Lightbringer by thrusting it through the heart of the wife he loved.
"He slew his wife to fight the dark. If Stannis's Azor Ahai come again, does that mean Edric Storm must play the part of Nisir Nisir?"
"I was thinking, maester, my pardons. What harm if some wildling king conquers the north?"
It was not as though Stannis held the north. His grace could scarcely be expected to defend people who refused to acknowledge him as king.
"Give me another letter," he said abruptly. "This one is too
difficult," suggested Pylos.
"Soon comes the cold," whispered Melisande, "and the night that never ends."
"Troubling," said Davos. "Too troubling. A different letter, please."
John. They woke to the smoke of Molestown burning. Atop the King's Tower, Jon Snow leaned on the padded crutch that Maester Aemon had given him and watched the grey plume rise. Stir had lost all hope of taking Castle Black unawares when Jon escaped him, yet even so he need not have warned of his approach so bluntly. "You may kill us," he reflected, "but no one will be butchered in their beds. That much I did, at least." His legs still hurt like blazes when he put his weight on it. He'd needed Clydus to help him don his fresh-washed blacks and lace up his boots that morning, and by the time they were done, he'd wanted to drown himself in the milk of the poppy. Instead, he had settled for half a cup of dream wine, a chew of willow bark, and the crutch. The beacon was burning on Weatherback Ridge, and the night's watch had need of every man. "I can fight," he insisted when they tried to stop him.
"Your legs healed, is it?
Noy snorted.
"You won't mind me giving it a little kick, then?"
"I'd sooner you didn't. It's stiff, but I can hobble around well enough, and stand and fight, if you have need of me."
"I have need of every man who knows which end of a spear to stab into the wildlings."
"The pointy end?" John had told his little sister something like that once, he remembered. Noy rubbed the bristle on his chin.
"Might be your do. We'll put you on a tower with a longbow. But if you bloody well fall off, don't come crying to me."
He could see the King's Road wending its way south through stony brown fields and over windswept hills. The Magnar would be coming up that road before the day was done, his thens marching behind him with axes and spears in their hands and their bronze and leather shields on their backs. Grig the Goat, Court, Big Boyle, and the rest will be coming as well. And Ygritte. The wildlings had never been his friends. He had not allowed them to be his friends. But her. He could feel the throb of pain where her arrow had gone through the meat and muscle of his thigh. He remembered the old man's eyes, too, and the black blood rushing from his throat as the storm cracked overhead. But he remembered the grotto best of all. The look of her naked in the torchlight, the taste of her mouth when it opened under his. "Ygritte, stay away. Go south and raid. Go hide in one of those round towers you like so well. You'll find nothing here but death." Across the yard, one of the bowmen on the roof of the old flint barracks had unlaced his breeches and was pissing through a crenel. Mully, he knew from the man's greasy orange hair. Men in black cloaks were visible on other roofs and tower tops as well, though 9 of every 10 happened to be made of straw.
"The scarecrow sentinels," Donal Noy called them.
"Only we're the crows," John mused, and most of us were scared enough. Whatever you call them, the straw soldiers had been Maester Aemon's notion. They had more breeches and jerkins and tunics in the storerooms than they had had men to fill them. So why not stuff some with straw, drape a cloak around their shoulders, and set them to standing watches? Noy had placed them on every tower and in half the windows. Some were even clutching spears, or had crossbows cocked under their arms. The hope was that the Thens would see them from afar and decide that Castle Black was too well defended to attack. John had 6 scarecrows, sharing the roof of the King's Tower with him, along with 2 actual breathing brothers. Deaf Dick Follard sat in a crenel, methodically cleaning and oiling the mechanism of his crossbow to make sure the wheel turned smoothly, while the Old Town boy wandered restlessly around the parapets, fussing with the clothes on straw men. Maybe he thinks they will fight better if they're posed just right. Or maybe this waiting is fraying his nerves the way it's fraying mine. The boy claimed to be 18, older than John, but he was green as summer grass for all that. Satin, they called him, even in the wool and mail and boiled leather of the night's watch. The name he'd gotten in the brothel where he'd been born and raised. He was pretty as a girl, with his dark eyes, soft skin, and raven's ringlets. Half a year at Castle Black had toughened up his hands, however, and Noy said he was passable with a crossbow. Whether he had the courage to face what was coming, though? John used a crutch to limp across the tower top. The King's Tower was not the castle's tallest. The high, slim, crumbling lance held that honour, though Othel Yarwick had been heard to say it might topple any day. Nor was the King's Tower strongest. The Tower of Guards beside the King's Road would be a tougher nut to crack. But it was tall enough, strong enough, and well placed beside the wall, overlooking the gate and the foot of the wooden stair. The first time he had seen Castle Black with his own eyes, John had wondered why anyone would be so foolish as to build a castle without walls. How could it be defended?
"It can't," his uncle told him. "That is the point. The Night's Watch is pledged to take no part in the quarrels of the realm. Yet over the centuries, certain lords commander, more proud than wise, forgot their vows and ne'er destroyed us all with their ambitions. Lord Commander Runcel Hightower tried to bequeath the watch to his bastard son. Lord Commander Rudrick Flint thought to make himself king beyond the wall. Tristan Mudd, Mad Mark Rankenfell, Robin Hill. Did you know that 600 years ago, the commanders at Snowgate and the Nightfort went to war against each other? And when the Lord Commander tried to stop them, they joined forces to murder him. The Stark in Winterfell had to take a hand, and both their heads, which he did easily because their strongholds were not defensible. The Night's Watch had 996 Lords Commander before Jor Mormont, most of them men of courage and honour, but we have had cowards and fools as well, our tyrants and our madmen. We survive because the lords and kings of the Seven Kingdoms know that we pose no threat to them, no matter who should lead us. Our only foes are to the north, and to the north we have the wall.
Only now those foes had gotten past the wall to come up from the south, John reflected, and the lords and kings of the Seven Kingdoms have forgotten us. We are caught between the hammer and the anvil. Without a wall, Castle Black could not be held. Donald Noy knew that as well as any.
"The castle does them no good," the armourer told his little garrison. "Kitchens, common hall, stables, even the towers. Let them take it all. We'll empty the armory and move what stores we can to the top of the wall and make our stand around the gate."
So Castle Black had a wall of sorts at last, a crescent-shaped barricade 10 feet high, made of stores, casks of nails and barrels of salt mutton, crates, bales of black broadcloth, stacked logs, sawn timbers, fire-hardened stakes, and sacks of grain. The crude rampart enclosed the two things most worth defending, the gate to the north and the foot of the great wooden switchback stair that clawed and climbed its way up the face of the wall like a drunken thunderbolt, supported by wooden beams as big as tree trunks driven deep into the ice. The last few moles were still making the long climb, John saw, urged on by his brothers. Gran was carrying a little boy in his arms, while Pip, two flights below, let an old man lean upon his shoulder. The oldest villagers still waited below for the cage to make its way back down to them. He saw a mother pulling along two children, one on either hand, as an older boy ran past her up the steps. 200 feet above them, Sky Blue Sue and Lady Meliana, who was no lady, all her friends agreed, stood on a landing looking south. They had a better view of the smoke than he did, no doubt. John wondered about the villagers who had chosen not to flee. There were always a few, too stubborn, or too stupid, or too brave to run, a few who preferred to fight, or hide, or bend the knee. Maybe the Thins would spare them. The thing to do would be to take the attack to them, he thought. With 50 rangers well mounted, we could cut them apart on the road. They did not have 50 rangers, though, nor half as many horses. The garrison had not returned, and there was no way to know just where they were, or even whether the riders that Noy had sent out had reached them. "We are the garrison," John told himself, "and look at us." The brothers Bowen Marsh had left behind were old men, cripples, and green boys, just as Donald Noy had warned him. He could see some wrestling barrels up the steps, others on the barricade. Stout old kegs, as slow as ever. Spare Boot, hopping along briskly on his carved wooden leg. Half-mad Easy, who fancied himself Florian the Fool reborn. Dornish Dilly. Red Allen of the Rosewood. Young Henley, well past 50. Old Henley, well past 70. Hairy Hal, Spotted Pate of Maidenpool. A couple of them saw John looking down from atop the King's Tower and waved up at him. Others turned away. "They still think me a turncloak." That was a bitter draught to drink, but John could not blame them. He was a bastard, after all. Everyone knew that bastards were wanton and treacherous by nature, having been born of lust and deceit. And he had made as many enemies as friends at Castle Black. Rast, for one.
John had once threatened to have Ghost rip his throat out unless he stopped tormenting Samuel Tarley, and Rest did not forget things like that. He was raking dry leaves into piles under the stairs just now, but every so often he stopped long enough to give John a nasty look.
No!
Donald Noy roared at three of the Molestown men down below.
The pitch goes to the hoist, the oil up the steps, crossbow bolts to the fourth, fifth, and sixth landings, spears to the first and second. Stack the lard under the stair. Yes, there, behind the planks. The casks of meat are for the barricade. Now, you puxy plough pushers, now!
He has a lord's voice, John thought. His father had always said that in battle a captain's lungs were as important as his sword arm. It does not matter how brave or brilliant a man is if his commands cannot be heard, Lord Eddard told his sons. So Rob and he used to climb the towers of Winterfell to shout at each other across the yard. Donald Noy could have drowned out both of them. The moles all went in terror of him, and rightfully so, since he was always threatening to rip their heads off. Three-quarters of the village had taken John's warning to heart and come to Castle Black for refuge. Noy had decreed that every man still spry enough to hold a spear or swing an axe would help defend the barricade, else they could damn well go home and take their chances with the Thens. He had emptied the armory to put good steel in their hands. Big double-bladed axes, razor-sharp daggers, long swords, maces, spiked morning stars. Clad in studded leather jerkins and mail hauberks, with greaves for their legs, and gorgets to keep their heads on their shoulders, a few of them even looked like soldiers. In a bad light, if you squint. Noy had put the women and children to work as well. Those too young to fight would carry water and tend the fires. The Molestown midwife would assist Clydus, and Maester Aemon would any wounded, and Three-Finger Hub suddenly had more spit-boys, kettle-stirrers, and onion-choppers than he knew what to do with. Two of the whores had even offered to fight, and had shown enough skill with a crossbow to be given a place on the steps 40 feet up. "It's cold," Satin stood with his hands tucked into his armpits under his cloak. His cheeks were bright red. John made himself smile. "The Frostfangs are cold. This is a brisk autumn day." "Well, I hope I never see the Frostfangs, then. I knew a girl in Oldtown who liked to ice her wine. That's the best place for ice, I think, in wine." Satin glanced south, frowned. "You think the Scarecrow sentinels scared them off, my lord?"
"We can hope."
It was possible, John supposed, but more likely the wildlings had simply paused for a bit of rape and plunder in Molestown. Or maybe Stir was waiting for nightfall to move up under cover of darkness. Midday came and went, with still no sign of Thens on the King's Road. John heard footsteps inside the tower, though, and Owen the Oaf popped up out of the trapdoor, red-faced from the climb. He had a basket of buns under one arm, a wheel of cheese under the other, a bag of onions dangling from one hand.
"Hobbs had to feed you in case you're stuck up here a while."
"That, or for our last meal." "Thank him for us, Owen." Dick Follard was deaf as a stone, but his nose worked well enough. The buns were still warm from the oven when he went digging in the basket and plucked one out. He found a crock of butter as well, and spread some with his dagger.
"Raisins," he announced happily. "Nuts, too."
His speech was thick, but easy enough to understand once you got used to it.
"You can have mine, too," said Satin. "I'm not hungry."
"Eat," John told him. "There's no knowing when you'll have another chance." He took two buns himself. The nuts were pine nuts, and besides the raisins there were bits of dried apple.
"Will the wildlings come today, Lord Snow?" Owen asked.
"You'll know if they do," said John. "Listen for the horns."
Two is for wildlings."
Owen was tall, tow-headed, and amiable. A tireless worker, and surprisingly deft, when it came to working wood and fixing catapults and the like, but as he'd gladly tell you, his mother had dropped him on his head when he was a baby.